So I will talk about something we call the fluid manifesto, and the reason for the name will become clear as I go along. And I will talk about two papers, one of which appeared, so they both are with my student Felix Howe and my collaborator Logan Iagam, who is at ICTS in India by way of IIS. And so the two papers, at least the ones I'll mainly talk about, are one which is titled The Fluid Manifesto from last October, and a second one which we sort of put out in a bit of a hurry thanks to competition from our friends at MIT, Hong Liu and his students. Which involves constructing effective actions for dissipative hydrodynamics. And a lot of what I want to say will be contained in these two papers, but much of my intuition for this comes from a paper we wrote early last year, which I will also refer here, which doesn't do much of what I'm going to talk about, but it sort of sets the stage by classifying what hydrodynamic theories actually are and understanding that it was something we worked out in the paper from last February. Okay, so the broad question I want to ask, and the sort of thing that motivates us, is the question of how exactly are we supposed to do Wilsonian RG if we start not from the vacuum state of some quantum field theory, but we start from some general density matrix. So imagine you're given some initial conditions, you're given some density matrix, and you want to, so this is the UV theory is given to you, and you want to sort of integrate out degrees of freedom and write down a low energy effective field theory which respects the usual rules of Wilson RG. So what is rules for and I won't have answers for you in general, but I'll try to argue that fluid dynamics is a test case, one where we understand, and thanks to some things that we've done, we actually know what we need to shoot for, and I'll try to convince you that there are structures that are built into density matrices that allow us to understand what goes on here. So perhaps, you know, there are many, many reasons to be interested in this question. I'll just list some of them. So this is just a good quantum field theory question. So we would like to understand this as quantum field theories. It's a question that crops up in the physics of black holes. And it's a question that immediately crops up again if you're talking about cosmology, where you sort of have access to part of the space-time and are ignorant of what's happening in the rest. So anytime we have some inbuilt ignorance in the system, we are in some kind of density matrix. And in all these questions, trying to write down low energy effective actions, one needs to, I will argue, one needs to update. Okay? And it's not so much that we don't...
What does dissipation, do you really mean an effective action or?
I really mean an effective action, and I will show an effective action which allows for dissipation.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes. So part of it is not new. Some elements are well known to some people. For hydrodynamics, the story is not known, and I'll give you an action which does the job. But part of the story is not so much that we would like sort of, I mean, we don't understand anything here. We understand the physics here reasonably well. We have good phenomenological intuition of what kind of low energy theories we would want to have. So hydrodynamics, for example, is case in point. There's a very good phenomenological theory of hydrodynamics, and we know it works very well. What we're after is not so much sort of understanding the phenomenology, but sort of giving as good first principles derivations as we can of that phenomenology from the usual rules of quantum field theory. Okay. So that's my goal. And perhaps I'll start by saying, you know, one of the natural way to deal with weak states. I mean, I could replace the word mixed states with open quantum systems. That are equivalent, as far as I'm concerned, it was provided by people in the 60s and in the early 60s. So goes by the name of the Schwinger, what I will call the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism. And I'll also mention, in this context, you know, one can motivate and derive the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism along the lines that was done by Feynman and Vernon in that beautiful paper of trying to work out influence functionals for open quantum systems, where you have a quantum system interacting with the reservoir and you integrate out the reservoir. So what gives in this? So if you want to sort of talk about the Schwinger-Keldysh, this formalism is perfect for understanding the microscopic physics. But it has natural tension when we start trying to integrate out, starting from the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism, the high energy modes, to write down an effective action that only involves the low energy. So what is the issue? The issue is simply that a density matrix is not a state, it's an operator. And to sort of represent it in the path integral, I need to double the number of degrees of freedom. In some sense, you can think of the density matrix as having both a bra and a ket involved in it, and you need to keep track of both the bra and the ket as you sort of evolve the system, and that is the sort of essential thesis behind the Schwinger-Keldysh construction. So let's say we do that, and I draw for you a usual Schwinger-Keldysh contour, which I'm going to draw like this. So I have some initial state. I evolve it forward. The state part of it evolves forward, and the conjugate state part of it evolves back. And here, I can imagine inserting various sources and computing correlation functions for both the state, for both the forward and backward evolution. And the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism is well constructed for doing precisely these type of computations.
What's the plane?
So this is a contour in the complex time plane. Okay. And if you could imagine, you could do it many ways. So one way is to sort of imagine that you do a little excursion in the imaginary time as you sort of write this contour, or you could imagine there are two decoupled contours with rho being some kind of operator that connects the two contours, the initial state. So the easy way to say it is you think of an initial density matrix as some kind of probability distribution. It builds in the entanglement between the left and right degrees of freedom. So if you have a density matrix, you purify it by working in the enlarged tensor product Hilbert space, and then you evolve in the enlarged Hilbert space. And since you are working in the enlarged Hilbert space, which is you've gone from the physical Hilbert space, I've doubled it. I'm going to write it as H left tensor H right. And this contour is a representation of the path integral evolution in this double Hilbert space. And I'm going to call this contour the top contour right, the bottom contour left. And as far, and there are rules here, which I will talk about in a second, of how to compute time-ordered correlators, how to do real-time correlation functions. But and that's as far as I'm concerned, is perfect at the level of computing physical quantities in the microscopic theory. So you give me the microscopic Lagrangian, I can do all these computations. But now if I start with this microscopic Lagrangian and say, OK, let me take this contour and try to integrate out the high energy modes. Let me try to derive the low energy effective theory, as I would usually do. Well, while there was microscopic UV entanglement built in, as you start integrating out modes, you will start having interactions between the two legs of the contour. Nothing prevents you, in a Wilsonian sense, from being able to write down all sorts of possible interaction terms between the left and right modes. A priori, the left and right modes were only entangled, they were not interacting. The theory was, the Lagrangian for this theory, the Schwinger-Keldysh Lagrangian, is right for the fields. Let me call it, let me label all the fields by phi. It's a difference of the physical action for the right fields minus the physical action for the left fields. And the relative sign simply comes from the forward evolution for the right fields and the reverse time evolution for the left fields. But upon integrating out, nothing prevents us from finding interaction terms which couple the right and left IR modes.
And let me see if I understand.
Yeah.
You mean, this is in the same sense that you would find non-local interactions when you do any kind of effective action. It's not that you're saying that interactions between phi r at one point and phi l at the corresponding point are preferred. This is generic.
No, this is just generic right-left. Yeah, the generic right-left mixing. But, and this is what I would say Feynman, I'm calling it INF because this is my reading of what Feynman and Vernon would have called influence functionals. Mm-hmm. But, you see, not all low energy influence functionals are consistent with microscopic unitarity. Okay? Subject to symmetries, should be allowed. And the question is, what is and what are the criteria? So that's the real question in this context. And if you sort of look through the literature, this is not a problem that we are the first to study. People have studied this over the last 50 years. And at various points, people come, try to address this question. But at various points, they make very good educated guesses to then go on to derive the low energy phenomenology. Okay. So the case in point, which I will talk about in the context of hydrodynamics, is that for any interacting quantum field theory, starting with a near thermal density matrix, we know that the low energy theory is hydrodynamics. But hydrodynamics comes with a set of, first of all, it doesn't manifest any of the Schwinger-Keldysh construction. So I'll explain how that is circumvented. But at the same time, the low energy theory of hydrodynamics, the phenomenological description of it involves a new ingredient. The new ingredient is the notion of entropy and the notion of second law. And if you sort of trace back what this entropy and the second law are doing, they are imposing on the macroscopic level some constraints on influence functionals that are allowed, which says that the system dissipates and not anti-dissipates. Okay? And you'd like to ask, why are those the preferred kind of interaction terms that are allowed in hydrodynamics as opposed to the generic interaction terms that you could have written down if you're just following your nose and being Wilsonian? Okay? So the test case for us to understand this is hydrodynamics and emergence of second law. And the reason we got interested in this dates back to a paper we wrote even before this, way back 2 or 3 years ago, where we were trying to understand something that has been much appreciated in the last decade of how microscopic flavor and Lorentz anomalies manifest themselves in hydrodynamic transport. So we wanted to see that, so we knew from first principle, from various other investigations, that anomalous contributions in thermal physics are interesting and can be computed by doing equilibrium phenomena. They're non-dissipative. So one would imagine, for reasons David pointed out, because they're non-dissipative, you should be able to derive them from some kind of effective action. And people had tried this, so the first people to try this were Dubovsky and friends, who managed to do this in two dimensions, but they failed in generalizing this construction to higher dimensions. So we tried about a while ago, and we realized that if we took a Schwinger-Keldysh-inspired effective action for hydrodynamics with a particular class of influence functionals, we could recover all known thermal anomalous contributions to thermal physics. Okay? So that was purely an empirical consideration. It wasn't some sort of first principles derivation, but it told us that we should start thinking seriously of how anomalies and hydrodynamics play, how influence functionals play a role in giving constraints on hydrodynamic transport. Then historically, then we went on to sort of analyze whether that was the full story. So this paper, which I mentioned here, we took the phenomenological axioms of hydrodynamics, namely that it's a theory of conserved currents, for satisfying the second law. And we said, can we find a complete structural solution to those phenomenological axioms? Can we find all possible transport that's admissible subject to the second law? And we gave an answer to that at the level of just doing usual hydrodynamic analysis. This is an analysis that could have been done by Landau-Lifshitz in the process of writing the textbook, but they didn't do it, so we finished it for them. And we said, can we derive, and we found that in addition to sort of what we usually expect in hydrodynamics, which is the dissipative transport, things like viscosities and friction, we found that there's a large class of transport that is genuinely non-dissipative. So we said, and so we had a classification, and we had what we called an eightfold classification. We had eight different classes of transport, only one of which was dissipative. So we said, can we write an effective action for seven classes? We found that we could write an effective action for two classes that sort of followed the rules of some usual Landau-Ginzburg theory, which I'll mention in a while. But for five other classes, we had to do some kind of Schwinger-Keldysh doubling and pick very particular influence functionals. Okay? We also had to introduce a new symmetry, which told us that those were the influence functionals to pick. So what I'm going to now do is explain that story backwards by motivating it from some completely different direction. Okay, so my goal is to sort of explain our classification, which I won't go into any detail because that's long and boring, but I'll show you how this all comes about if we look at the structure of the Schwinger-Keldysh path integral and take some of the rules very seriously. Okay, so that's what I'm after. So let me start from this picture and talk about the following. So let's say that this contour that I drew in the complex time plane computes for me the generating functional for correlation functions in the tensor product Hilbert space, which I'm going to call ZSK. And I'll write this as follows. So I have my initial density matrix rho. I'm going to imagine that the forward leg of the contour, I evolve unitarily from the initial state with random classical sources thrown in so they can functionally integrate, functionally differentiate and get correlation functions. So I'm going to call that UR, where R stands for the right sources. So this is some. And likewise, on the reverse segment, I'll have left sources, but I have the conjugate evolution because I'm evolving backwards in time. Okay? So this is formally the structure of the generating functional of Schwinger-Keldysh. Now, because of this minus sign, one useful fact to remember is that the source coupling to operators has a Lorentz signature matrix. Right operators and right sources couple to each other, but there's a relative sign in that from the left operators and left sources. Of course, we can simplify this and write this in a form that I find useful. Let me introduce what's usually called the average difference basis. and similarly for the sources. So I can just pass from what is usual. So if you think of the left operators as time-like and the right operators as space-like, there's a Lightcon basis that you can go to. And in the Lightcon basis, the difference source couples to the average operator, and the average source couples to the difference operator. Okay. Now, imagine we do this contour, but we turn on the same sources for the left and right. Okay, so I make this source. Let me put these sources here. But if I have the same sources, then the two unit trees are the same. I can use the cyclicity of the trace to get rid of the unit trees. And this object is just trace row. In other words, turning on equal sources in Schwinger-Keldysh boils down to the theory of initial conditions. Nothing happens. It's like a time fold where nothing happens. What that means from the generating function is the following statement about correlation functions. That any correlation function of any number of difference operators is zero. Because I can get difference operators by turning on average sources without turning on relative sources. And I turn on an average source, I get nothing. So we know this, everybody knows this at the level of two-point functions. There are only, so in this contour, there would be I could insert two sources up here, two sources down here, a source up here, a source down here, or vice versa. But there are only three non-trivial two-point functions. There's an advanced, retarded, and a Whiteman function. There isn't a fourth two-point function because that guy is zero. But this is a well-known word identity, that's true in Schwinger-Keldysh. But it's a remarkable statement because it's a statement that's true independent of dynamics. It's completely blind to what microscopic theory I chose. It's completely blind to what density matrix I chose. For any quantum field theory, this is an identity. Now, it's rather strange, if you think about it, that we'd have a whole sector of a theory which doesn't care for what the dynamics is and has vanishing correlators. But there's one class of theories where we know this is true. Okay? If we assume there's a BRST symmetry, and these operators are BRST exact, then BRST invariance guarantees us that these correlation functions would be automatically zero. Okay? And so I'm going to claim that the Schwinger-Keldysh construction comes equipped with a BRST charge, which I'll call QSK, and its conjugate anti-BRST charge, Q bar SK, which enforce this word identity.
That's an assumption, right?
I can derive this for you.
But you're actually going
to
derive
it. Well, I won't derive it now, but I can derive it for you because the way to think about it is that the Schwinger-Keldysh doubles. But once you double, you introduce redundancy. Okay? And the redundancy is simply field redefinitions, and the field redefinitions which are concerted field redefinitions in the left and right. Okay? And the field redefinition BRST, just like gauge invariance Fadia-Popov BRST, is the Schwinger-Keldysh BRST. Okay? So this is, we don't need to do very much work to derive this, but it's something that one can derive. So what I would need is that O difference is Q SK of something and Q bar SK of something. And the moment that is true, and if my action is BRST invariant, then it follows that those correlation functions would be zero. So my first take-home message from this picture is that let's not be conservative and double in Schwinger-Keldysh. Let's just quadruple. Because I need something here where O difference of the bosonic operator, let's say. Okay, let's just say we're doing a scalar field. O diff is a difference of the left and right scalar fields. It's Q of something. Q by construction is nilpotent object. It's Grassmann odd. So I need Grassmann odd object sitting inside here. So I'm going to just build up a structure that's familiar from the form of n equals 1 superfields. So I'm going to say that I have the O diff being the top component of a superfield whose bottom component is the average, the physical field. So in statistical mechanics language, this guy is called the classical object, and this guy will be called the quantum fluctuation object, okay, which I'll show you later when we talk about one-to-one dynamics. And there's a ladder constructed by the Qs. So given an operator O, which could be a right operator, say, I associate it with a triple Grassmann odd partner with ghost number plus one, a Grassmann odd partner with ghost number minus one, and its difference object. Okay? And this I claim is true for any density matrix, and it would enforce this word identity. Okay? And this mileage you get for free just by the Schwinger-Keldysh construction. And it explains all the statements that you would see in the usual rules of Schwinger-Keldysh calculus, because usual rules of Schwinger-Keldysh calculus give you rules of how to do computation of correlation functions, time-ordered correlation functions, and all of those can be derived in using this language. So that's good, but I want to now argue that there is more for a special class of density matrices which involve thermal physics. But before I do that, maybe I should first ask if people are still happy about the statement or if they have questions.
One question about something you were saying a little bit earlier about starting off with this action integrating out degrees of freedom. But can you just, doesn't the path integral just factorize over the right and the left, and then you could do the integrals and it stays decoupled?
No, but you see, the rho necessarily entangles the right and the left. Rho by construction entangles right and left. Otherwise, the theory would have factorized from the beginning. So the UV modes are non-trivially entangled. So as I integrate them out, they will introduce interactions between the IR modes, because the UV IR modes on each side talk to the UV modes on each side, but they are entangled across each other. So that's what I'm removing.
So this action isn't capturing everything.
This is the microscopic story. Everything I described here is so far microscopic. So I'm not doing RG. I want to take lessons from this microscopic that are robust to integrating out. One statement I want to make is topological symmetries are robust. So existence of this guy is a guidepost for us for writing down low energy effective theories. Okay.
Well, that theory itself is a bit misleading at first, but I think if you have, in suppose the Riddle construction, then we have a conjugate Hamiltonian that should have very fine tuning at the horizon such that so there is no infinity. So there will be a proper amount of entanglement which will be captured in the derivatives of phi in the horizon. So when you figure that out, that would.
All those things, if that's your action in an ordinary path integral, it looks like that thing, if you try and would stay factorized.
That I'm claiming would not be true. At least it would definitely not give you any other physical dissipation that we know in the low energy theory.
Maybe you should just explain for Edgar what the full path integral is that you'll be doing.
Yeah, so the full path integral.
It's not just the integral of e to the ISK.
Yeah, so the full path integral.
Okay.
Yeah. Got it?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the power we think we can do for the general story, but I want to now talk about thermal density matrices, or near thermal density matrices, where I'll make the assumption that the statement I'm about to make extend to. So rho is given in terms of some e to the minus beta h. And here, the contour I want to think about is the same contour, except that I then evolve back in Euclidean time by an amount beta. And suppose we're in equilibrium for the moment. We're in exact thermal equilibrium, where this, where we're computing equilibrium correlators. Then this thermal correlation function, the Swinger-Keldysh thermal correlation function, satisfies the new condition. Which is correlators are analytic in the Euclidean time strip of width beta. Okay, so, and this is usually stated as the KMS condition. So KMS didn't call it the KMS condition. And one way to think about it is that you can take one of the operators, say the left operator, and you can time translate it by an amount given by the imaginary period. And you can identify O at T with OL at T minus I beta. As far as inserting in correlation functions are concerned, these two operators are equivalent. This is the statement of this periodicity in Euclidean time. Okay. So let me call this operator O tilde L of T. And a consequence, a corollary of basically of my earlier observation and the KMS condition, is a second some rule which says in thermal physics that correlation functions of operators where I have shifted not to differences but differences involving thermal translates also vanishes. So, I played the game once, I can play it again. I'm just going to assert now that there's a second set of BRST charges associated with this KMS translation. Okay.
I have a stupid question.
Yeah.
If we're just doing normal field theory with one contour,
mm-hmm.
and then I write O of 0 in terms of O of T, like O of 0 is U of T, and then I say correlation. Now I take the operator O of 0 written in this way minus O of 0,
mm-hmm.
and then say all its correlation functions are 0, because the operator is just 0.
Wait, no, but
O of T new dagger minus O of 0 is just 0.
But what you're computing in Heisenberg picture is O of T, O of 0, which is not 0. Whereas the KMS condition asserts that operators which are thermally translated in equilibrium are the same operator inside correlation function.
Is there no analog that I can do with a single contour of what you're doing?
I don't know of one.
What's your contour? Is your contour just a real line? Like, you know,
yeah, he just has one.
Minkowski space, where is your contour some theory that inherently lives on a circle? If the latter, then there's an analog. If
yeah.
it's a real line, there's no analog.
Yeah. You have a question, Jim? So claim that there exists two more BRST charges, which I will call QKMS, QBarKMS, which implement this kind of word identity for me, for thermally translated operators. Now, you should rightly, so the previous statement I said we can derive because it's just field definitions. This one you should be a bit more cautious about because this relates operators at one time to operators that are finite time separated from it because these don't act locally on the space. But I'm going to work in the limit eventually that they do act locally. So you can think of this, a new triangle which says that there is a, whatever this is, this hierarchy, which brings me down to O right minus O left. And I've chosen to move the left operator down as opposed to moving the right operator up, which is required by CPT. So the statement I want to argue for is that thermal or near thermal density matrices, by virtue of the Schwinger-Keldysh construction, come equipped with four superchargers which satisfy the following algebra. All four operators are nilpotent, and the only non-zero commutator is between a KMS BRST supercharge and its corresponding Schwinger-Keldysh anti-BRST supercharge.
Wait, is that the unitary or the generator of thermal?
It's a generator of thermal infinitesimal. It's a generator of thermal translation. It takes an operator around a thermal circle.
So it is a unitary, or it's e to the I p, as it were.
Yeah, that's right. So this is the algebra I'm going to work with. I'm going to show you that this algebra is known.
And Q commutes with the
Hamiltonian.
Okay.
Commutes with Hamiltonian. This thermal translation just translates me by beta in time.
But you only get these extra two operators when you're exactly in a thermal state.
Or I'm going to assume that that extends to near thermal states, local equilibrium. Yeah. So yes, but the full power is only true in thermal states. I am confused and would welcome input. You may ask, if you have a general density matrix, I could play the same game like KMS by working not with ordinary evolution, but with modular evolution. You may wonder whether the modular Hamiltonian allows you to write a modular algebra of this kind. I remain agnostic of this fact. I'm not convinced it happens, but if that's true, then you can make use of that in general. Okay. The difference would be that with a modular Hamiltonian, that object is non-local, and there is no scale at which it becomes local. Whereas in a thermal case, if I'm trying to do long wavelength physics in near equilibrium, then I'm looking at this operator on scales much longer than a thermal scale. The non-locality scale is very short, so you might assume that there is a local representative in that effective field theory description, which is what I'm going to do. Okay. Now, one comment for in passing, I want to explain this fact. This algebra is very, very well known. Okay. This algebra is the algebra you get when you take n equals 4 Supriyang Mills and twist it as was done by Bafan Witten to talk about S-duality. It's what's called in literature as the extended equivariant cohomology algebra with two topological supercharges. Okay, so this is what Digraph and Moore in their paper on balanced topological field theories called the extended NT equals two algebra. There's a simple way to think about it. If you just do usual differential calculus, there's an algebra satisfied by these three objects, exterior derivation, lead derivatives, and interior contractions. You know, the anti-commutator of a exterior derivative with interior contraction is a lead derivative. Commutator of lead derivative is a lead derivative of commutator. And so you can build an algebra. This is called the Weyl algebra. which is the story behind equivariant cohomology. This is the same thing, but with two additional structure. So, and in that language, these guys are like interior contractions, and the Schwinger-Kell discharges are like exterior derivations. Okay. So I think this algebra has been sort of found more than once in literature, but the sort of place where it's cleanly explained is this Diagraph Moore paper from 95 or 96. Okay. So this is all very abstract, but let me try to do an example before I jump into hydrodynamics. The example is going to be very simple-minded. It's just a point particle in an external potential subject to random noise, undergoing frictional motion, what's called the Langevin equation. Again, this discussion is standard. The first place where this dynamics and finding an effective action for Langevin system and concomitant BRST symmetries, not this full extended structure, but at least two BRST symmetries, was in 1973, much before anybody thought about twisted supersymmetric field theories by Martin C.G. and Rose. So it's well known in the condensed matter literature. What you can think of, and it's the same theory that you get when you try to look at it's the same description as Witten's supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Okay, so I'm going to do it in 1D, but you can generalize it to arbitrary dimensions, and the effective action you would get is Witten's supersymmetric quantum mechanics action. So here's the action. So I have some inertial term. I have a particle x position parameterized by some time coordinate t. It undergoes, let me get my factors right because I want to get this fluctuation dissipation result correct. Let me write this operator here for a second. So particle with some inertial term, some external potential u with dissipation friction term nu. Del beta is basically this thermal translation operator. There's a factor of beta here because this is beta d by dt roughly. And I put the factor of beta here because eventually nu, which is friction, is related by Einstein relation to dissipation, to fluctuation. And so the noise term has a kernel which is also given in terms of nu. So I've sort of built that in, but we'll see how this works out. So to answer David's question, this is explicitly a dissipative system. So how do I write an effective action for it? So the answer is you double. Okay. You double and introduce these auxiliaries to keep track of what's happened. They implement fluctuation dissipation. And the Martin C.G. Rose trick is very, very simple. Say you want to compute correlation functions. So what you would want to do is you take this. So n is some stochastic variable. It has some probability distribution. You solve this equation for x for a given noise. You solve it again for another noise. And then you sort of find classical solutions. And then you can ask for correlation functions of x at different times with noise averaging. Okay? That's the kind of object we would want to compute in this theory. If we were doing quantum field theory, I would extend this to something more general. Well, I'm computing correlators of on-shell gadgets. I could, of course, replace this by a functional integral over x with delta function of x minus x classical. I can replace this delta function by chain rule as delta function of equation of motion with a Jacobian involving the variation of equation of motion. Just the chain rule for delta function, functional chain rule for delta functions. But we all know the trick. The moment you say delta function and you say Jacobian, we know what to do. You exponentiate the delta function with a Lagrange multiplier field, and you exponent the Jacobian with Gauss. So that was Martin St. John Rose's trick. And when the dust settles, if I do this for this problem, I get a nice Schwinger-Keldysh Lagrangian, which I just write out. So X tilde is going to be the Lagrange multiplier field, what's usually called in Fadia-Popov language the Nakanishi-Lautrup field. And I'll write it as follows. Okay, the signs here, which sort of are not important, but they're coming from just exponentiating. So X tilde is going to be the Lagrange multiplier, and psi and psi bar are going to be the Gauss. And what I did was I assumed that my noise here was Gaussian weighted with weight nu and integrated out the noise, because if you see, the Lagrange multiplier couples linearly to the noise, so I can integrate it out, and that's what gives me this X tilde squared term after integrating out the noise. So this is an effective action for a dissipative system. You have everything you want. And the key thing to note is this piece and this piece are correlated. That's the statement of fluctuation dissipation. So sign of the way the ghosts talk to each other says convergence of the path integral requires this to have a definite sign, the ghost action to have a definite sign. That tells you the system dissipates and not anti-dissipates if nu is positive.
Wait, and is there a sign missing somewhere in the question?
Let's see. So there's an overall minus sign, I think.
No, every time the fermions show up, they're quadratic except on that term.
So. Oh, sorry. This was psi. What am I talking about? Yeah. Yeah, sorry. Everything is basically the way you get this. The fermionic pieces are just obtained by varying this one with respect to x, right? So you remove the x and put the fermion there. So that's the action. That's as I said, it's dated. It's 40 years old. What's not appreciated is that this action has this entire symmetry structure that I talk about, this n equals 2 symmetry structure. So which I won't show you. You can write down all the charges, but roughly the multiplet structure is X, psi, psi bar.
Wait, that seems fishy because we have twice as many supersymmetries when we expect four fermion partners.
So it's important that all in this case, the two of the supersymmetries. So there's a way to rewrite this, and I'll explain this when I do hydrodynamics, that these two supercharges, the KMS supercharges, you should think of them as implementing gauge transformations along some gauge field, which I haven't talked about yet. So I'll come to that, but this structure is sufficient, actually. Questions. All right. So we worked this out, and I can go through it in offline in detail of how to rewrite this, how to obtain this action from first principles using the symmetries, and show you how to write it exactly as this NT equals two theory, which reduces at the end of the day. So if you do this not with particle probing one dimension, but a particle moving on some manifold, you will get Witten's topological supersymmetric quantum mechanics model. All right. So now I want to, if there are no questions, I want to move on to talking about hydrodynamics and show you how to use this structure to write down an effective field theory for effective action for hydrodynamic degrees of freedom. Okay. So actually, I'm going to take this model as inspiration because it's actually quite useful. So microscopically in fluid dynamics, we still have thermal density, local thermal equilibrium, but not global thermal equilibrium. So we have sort of the left and right degrees of freedom as I drew before. And which means that if I think of I'll just talk about energy momentum. We can talk about charges. It just makes life more complicated. So to get energy momentum, I can, of course, turn on a background matrix source for the right fields. I can turn on a background matrix source for the left fields and define a left and right energy momentum tensor. So microscopically, the theory has the following symmetry. It has d phi o left times d phi o right. So the sort of global symmetries of this problem. Now, none of this is visible in the low energy theory. And I claim it's not visible simply because the maximal separation between the left and right fields in local equilibrium is the thermal scale. And if I look at the physics on scales much bigger than the thermal scale, I don't see a distinction between the left and right fields, which is part of the reason I started arguing that I can make these charges local. Okay. So I claim that the right way to think about hydrodynamics is a symmetry breaking pattern where these two diffeos of Schwinger-Keldysh are broken down to a common diagonal diffeo that talks to the physical fields. And the physical fields, I remind you, are the left plus right fields, not the fluctuating fields, the analog of this X field of Langevin dynamics. Okay, and I want to employ the same kind of intuition that we would use in chiral symmetry breaking, where I have global symmetries, which are broken down to some diagonal, and if you look at it, it has the right number of degrees of freedom. Breaking of two diffeos down to a diagonal leaves behind a vector's worth of Goldstone bosons. And the low energy degrees of freedom in hydrodynamics are precisely one vector's worth of degrees of freedom. Because hydro, the phenomenological theory of hydro, is we have a velocity field which is normalized, and we have a temperature. So in d dimensions, this has d minus one components, and the scalar component is made up by the local temperature. I'm just going to find it convenient to talk about this quantity, the unnormalized velocity, and think of this as a pion for broken diffeos in the hydrodynamic theory. So the moment you see this, you say, look, why don't I just write down a much simpler theory, which is just a Landau-Ginzburg theory for these Goldstone modes. Okay? That's what we would do when we see analog of chiral Lagrangian, just write down a sigma model for these Goldstone modes. So let me do that, but let me do it as the following way. So let me think of the physical fluid. And as I did in the Langevin case, let me parameterize some auxiliary space, which is like the proper time parameterization for the Langevin dynamics, which is I will call some kind of reference world volume. And this has some intrinsic coordinate sigma. The physical fluid lives in a space with physical coordinates x mu. And I think of this as some kind of sigma model with x mu of sigma a being the analog of this pions. And to get the local temperature, I will put in a reference vector field on this this world volume, which pushed forward will give me the temperature at every point in physical spacetime. In string theory language, just think of hydrodynamics as a theory of a space-filling D-brain with a preferred vector field that knows about the orientation and the local inertial frame and local temperature at every point. So you can do this. And this was our first attempt, and this was done in our paper last year. So we can write down a world volume theory of a generally covariant action involving, so there's a physical metric, which is the sort of background source for the energy momentum tensor, physical energy momentum tensor. And if you pull it back, there's some pullback matrix, so you can write down some world volume theory involving this pullback matrix and this temperature field. And you can show two things. You can show that this Landau-Ginzburg model gives correct equilibrium predictions. And it generalizes it to what I would call Lagrangian non-dissipative hydro. In our classification, this forms 2 out of 8 classes. The equilibrium physics is something that you see in Euclidean constructions, and the Lagrangian stuff is stuff that vanishes in equilibrium, which involves necessarily time dependence, but doesn't produce entropy. In the Langevin description, think of this guy as the Lagrangian piece, the inertial term, necessarily involves time derivatives of the physical field. And this guy, which is just the potential, is the analog of the equilibrium phase, sort of spatial potential, which tells you how the particle is moving in the manifold. Okay. So we knew this worked, but we also knew that this was incomplete. It didn't capture what we knew of the general structure of hydrodynamics, because there's a lot more to hydrodynamics than this class of transport. Okay. Oh, one other thing. So energy momentum tensor, of course, is obtained by varying this guy with respect to the metric. And I'll write everything on this world volume. The physical objects are, of course, obtained by push forward. Just multiply them by the appropriate push forward. The nice thing is that since this theory doesn't produce entropy, there's an entropy current here, which is simply obtained by Noether construction. Okay. So if you do the canonical variation of the Lagrangian, there's some presymplectic form, and that presymplectic form gives you the correct fluid dynamical entropy current. Okay. Something we're very familiar with in the context of black holes. But this does work exactly the same way in a theory of non-dynamical matrix. Okay. A point that actually was somewhat appreciated by Vivek Iyer in a paper that he wrote in a little bit after the Wald Iyer paper, where they talked about the Noether construction for black hole entropy. But he was only interested in ideal fluids, which was all there was in those days. But the claim is, you can do this. You can do this to arbitrary orders in the hydrodynamic expansion, and it works. But it is incomplete. So how do we upgrade? So, you know, we spent some time, and I'll tell you the upshot of what we came to. So we realized that the right way to upgrade, purely empirically, is to extend this Landau-Ginzburg construction by including a fluctuating metric on the world volume, purely inspired by along the lines of X tilde, and a gauge field call it ATA, which implements thermal translations. Okay. I'm going to gauge thermal translations in this construction. And after some, when the dust settles, there's a Lagrangian, which I will call the adiabatic Lagrangian, which is just up to some factors which I won't worry about. This is the free energy current, basically Legendre transform of entropy current, pulled back to the world volume. This is the physical energy momentum tensor. This, everything can be functional of G tilde and AT, but this was our construction, and we showed that these thermal translations, these gauge fields, they actually closed and formed an interesting algebra, which was a non-trivial check to implement. But you see something nice here. This construction, although at that time we didn't realize, is exactly of this form. There's a linear coupling between this G tilde and the physical fields. Here, X tilde couples linearly to the physical fields. The only term which is quadratic is the fluctuation term. So hydrodynamics will be much more complicated. We expect nonlinear fluctuations. Langevin is special in that Langevin is a linear fluctuating field. There's only linear dissipation. Hydrodynamics has nonlinear dissipation. But this lends us confidence in thinking that perhaps we should take this philosophy seriously and try to construct an effective action which embodies the structure here and the structure I talked about earlier involving these BRSTC metrics. Okay, so I'll give you the answer. How much time do I have? 0 minutes?
Yeah,
5 minutes? Okay. So we took as our sort of symmetries the following to we are going to write down a world volume theory with this extended BRST symmetry. So super diffeomorphisms on this world volume. This what I will call a UNT KMS gate symmetry. And in addition, CPT and target space. Super diffuse. All of which I'm not explaining, to write down a topological theory which would give us the correct constitutive relations, and the physical currents are obtained by deforming this topological theory by turning on different sources. Okay, so that was the logic. And I don't have much to write, so let me just write here a few sort of the easy way to do all this is to write everything in superspace and introduce super coordinates and upgrade everything to superfields and write a superspace Lagrangian, which basically takes some scalar density in the superspace, which is of this form for the adiabatic part. And then you add a term involving, I want to get dissipation, which this does not have still, even after upgrading to superspace. I won't write this measure is because the U1T induces some non-trivial measure here. But we can write down an effective action which reproduces what we had before. And we can allow for dissipation exactly the same way as we allowed for it here, linear couplings of the dissipative term to derivatives. These derivatives are obtained in superspace language by taking derivatives along the super directions. And the way I've taken this, I've taken as the theta and theta bar of ghost number plus minus one. So this combination gives me a ghost number zero object, which gives you the right thing. And you can check, if once I show you the rules of this calculus, that this guy accounts for all the non-dissipative coefficients. For our classification from before, you just need a full tensor which is symmetric in pairwise and symmetric in exchange of pairs, which is built out of all the world volume fields that you have. Okay. And finally, you may ask, okay, we imposed lots of funny things. What do we gain out of this? So one thing I didn't get to talk about is I motivated this construction by talking about the second law. So where is the second law in this game? So the modern way of thinking about the second law, I think, is along the lines of what's called the Yarzynski relation, which is a general statement of fluctuation dissipation in non-equilibrium physics. It simply says that the exponential of work done ensemble averaged over all protocols is the exponential of the free energy difference between the starting point and the point where you turn off all the sources which do the work. And it has been known for a few years that for the Langevin dynamics, you can derive Yarzynski as a statement of a super, as a word identity arising from the background supersymmetry. Okay, so this was done a few years ago by Malik, Moshe, and Orland, and I recommend papers by Gaspard, who worked this out quite nicely in very simple toy models. But once we have this world volume theory with various supersymmetry, with all the structures built in, one can go away and implement the same construction, write down the word identity, understand what CPT transformations mean, and see that on the nose you land up with the Yarzynski relation for nonlinear hydrodynamics. And this, I claim, is sufficient to derive the second law, because what this relation implies, if you use the first law of thermodynamics, it says that the exponential of entropy produced has expectation value plus one, ensemble averaged. But the exponential is a convex function so the on average, the entropy has to grow for this to be true. So this is how the second law arises, despite the fact that we have entropy coupling to a conserved gauge symmetry. And one way to think about it is that the physical entropy that one measures is the entropy of the physical constituent hydrodynamic modes. And what compensates for it is the various growths attendant in this hydrodynamic construction, which carry away the entropy from the physical degrees of freedom. So they play the role of the underlying reservoir that you would have sort of seen microscopically. So as you integrate out the microscopic degrees of freedom, what get left behind and implement microscopic unitarity are the various curves. And I will leave you with a provocative thought that perhaps this has lessons to teach us about black holes.
Just review some of the big picture. You said it this last bit that you just sketched.
Yeah.
This BRST symmetry is really essential, at least in your argument, for deriving the Yarzynski relation in this context.
Correct. BRST plus how CPT acts on the BRST charges. Yes. So CPT exchanges these two guys. Because you see, the second law is a statement about time reversal. You know, you need to understand how these discrete symmetries act as well. It's not enough to just say BRST.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Questions? Thank you.